The desired effect is what you get when you improve your interplanetary funksmanship.
Well, all right. Big man, the people.
Rest in peace, Bernie Worrell. Welcome, everybody, to the SAFTAcast, the only podcast that talks to writers, editors, and publishers about everything except writing, editing, or publishing. Well, kind of, sort of, maybe on this episode, see if we kind of get into it. Never mind, we'll get to that in just a moment. Welcome, everybody, to the SAFTAcast, episode 56, The Return of Neil Akin. But we'll get to that in just a moment. It is time, once again, for everyone's favorite part of this program. Well, maybe not your favorite, but it's one of my favorites. Of course, the whole show is my favorite, but anyway, I digress. I am talking about the latest news and updates and information from the SunTrust Academy for the Arts, SunTrust Publications, and this show, the SAFTAcast. And let's talk about us today, shall we? Let's. You might be thinking to yourself, Scott C., the SAFTAcast is going along nicely, there's steady downloads and everything. What you got coming up for us in the near future? Well, let me tell you, we are working on a number of things. We are talking about maybe doing another little contest in August, early September. We're toying with that idea. We've got a few things on the back burner, including expanding our audience, and that's where you can come in. See, we've got a lot of steady downloads and a lot of people liking us and everything, and it's great, but we could always use more. If you want to support this program, there are many ways that you can do it. One is to follow us on Facebook by finding us there at facebook.com/SAFTAcast, SAFTACAST. Finding us on Twitter and following us there at SAFTAcast, same name as the program. And, of course, passing on the show to friends, family, co-workers, etc., people that you think would really dig this program. And the best thing you can do for us, honestly, the best thing. If you enjoyed this program and all the fun that comes with it, rate us, review us on iTunes. It would be a big help to us getting our name out there and the myriad of podcasts that are out there about writers, editors, and publishers. And we're one of the better ones, I like to think. But, of course, I'm a little biased there. But maybe you're a little biased as well. In all seriousness, one of the best things you can do for us is rate us, review us on iTunes, and soon to hopefully be on a number of other podcasting platforms. We'll keep you posted on that information. See, there are many ways that you can help us out at the program, because as is talked about on today's episode, we don't charge anything for this podcast. There's no cost involved, at least on your end. And we don't solicit money or anything from anybody. We do this as a labor of love. And speaking of labors of love, it is all about today. You see, folks, summer months are a great time for reunions. That's when you hear about a lot of family reunions taking place, and indeed I had a few of my own this year when I took a little summer break and holiday myself around the country and met up with a lot of friends and family I hadn't seen and talked to in a long time, and I came back home and I wanted to carry on that spirit here on the program. So I reached out to some of our former guests and asked them, hey, you want to come back for a second time and come join us again and catch up? And they said, sure, and today have we got one for you. Neil Akin reached out to us and said, I'd love to come back. And we said, that would be awesome, Neil. Come on back. We love you. And so as you'll soon see, or rather hear, we get into quite a bit about what Neil's been up to since the last time he was on the program. We find out what the current status is with his green card application and what he's been up to while that's going on in the background. And one of those things is indeed his website, Have Book Will Travel. That's all one word, Have Book Will Travel. Kind of like Paladin, you know, Have Gun Will Travel reads the card of a man. Well, Have Book Will Travel reads the Earl of this website. We spend a good time of the episode talking about that, and I'll tell you right now, folks, if you go there, you visit it, it's not just a database of writers and reading series and trying to bring them together, but even if you don't run a reading series or anything, you can find some really kick-ass authors on there, some new people to start reading, to check out. I encourage you to visit the site Have Book Will Travel, and to keep your eyes and ears open, because as we talk about, Neil is getting into the podcasting game a little bit with two different shows, and we talk a lot about what we might expect from both of them. But that's all coming at you in just a moment here. First, I believe there's a little matter of a theme song. We'll be right back. also makes it more feel more like radio to me. I don't know.
That's true. If we're just recording, we don't really need to see each other's faces.
True. Not that there's anything interesting to see anyway. You know. At least on my end. That's not a shot at you.
Well, there's nothing really in my room either to really show off. So,
the fact
is ridiculously blank behind me. And a neutral color that is so neutral that, it looks like I'm in a passport photo most of the time when I'm on Skype.
Did you paint that room yourself, or was that the way it came?
It's the room that, so I'm staying with relatives right now, so it's my aunt's Mary Kay office, which is kind of a pale pink.
And that's probably deliberate then, the Mary Kay aesthetic.
Yes.
So how have you been, man? It's been a long time since we chatted with you.
Has it been that long? I guess it has.
The last time we spoke to you was you were just finishing off your dissertation.
Yeah, and that seemed like an ongoing process.
It's still not complete?
No, it did. It did finish up. There was an added wrinkle where I ended up having to rewrite an entire chapter.
Ooh.
And so, yeah, so I walked, and then 3 months later, I was still working things out with my dissertation committee on the last chapter.
What happened with that chapter?
You know, sometimes you just arrive at the end of a project and you're exhausted, and you might have all the information in your head, but you don't really put the full effort into translating into writing. And they kind of saw that. They saw, well, you know, you talk a lot about these things, but you really haven't delivered in this chapter on those things that appear to be central to your argument and central to your creative work. And so they pushed back, and rightly so, and I kind of grudgingly went back and rewrote the whole chapter to address some of their concerns and to really do more due diligence with the material that I had and really to pay it the respect it deserved. So it was kind of aggravating because I was really, really ready to be done at that point.
But is it done now?
Oh, yeah. I got the paperwork in December that said, yes, you're officially done. By the way, do you want to walk again? She said, no, I'm done. I don't want to come back and walk a second time. That seems really ridiculous.
You did get to walk, though, then.
Yeah, I walked before, like at the end of the spring semester. So just before summer, you know, the traditional end of the semester. I walked with everyone else. And at the time, I assumed that we would be able to resolve things with that chapter before the end of summer. But instead, my committee decided to, well, you know, some of my committee ended up traveling, and so they really didn't pay any attention to the chapter until they got back. So I didn't get feedback until end of August, beginning of September. So
makes sense, yeah. So, but a lot has happened to you, I'm willing to bet, in like the last year and a half, let's say, then?
Yeah.
It's been pretty chaotic. I remember, just to fill our listeners in a little bit, you know, I know that one thing went down was the whole Kickstarter campaign for you, the GoFundMe.
Yeah, I ran a GoFundMe to fund a green card application, which the most recent status is that it is in process, which means that they haven't made a decision yet.
Could be a long time, I'm guessing.
They should have a decision by the end of summer, is usually how it works. Usually it takes, for this particular category, the process usually takes somewhere around 6 or 7 months, occasionally up to 9 months. And I've heard that there have been delays this year with this particular category of applications. So, you know, it might not be until end of August or sometime in September before we actually get a final decision. But, you know, in terms of my lawyer and myself, we've got our part done. It's just a waiting game. It's a long, protracted process. And, you know, while the clock is ticking, you know, there are incidental charges and fees that creep into my legal expenses. So it's like, I feel like I'm not done paying either. So I'm still paying off parts of my legal expenses for this too.
I don't envy you having to go any kind of legal issue, no matter what it is. I don't envy someone for having to go through it.
Right. And here's the irony of it, or maybe not the irony. The sad part of it is that this is actually the fastest and cheapest route to a green card. It's not the cheapest in the sense that it would be cheaper if someone else foot the bill, right? But it is the cheapest in terms of the actual total price. And the actual total price by the end of this will probably be about $8,000. And that's the cheapest you can go.
Man, I know very little when it comes to the immigration law and the process. And every time I hear about it, I'm like, this is worse than Disney World lines or amusement park rides could ever be.
Yeah. Just
the amount of hoops you have to go through and the cost and everything.
And some of it's just nickel and dime. You get hit with like, oh, by the way, while you're applying for this, you need to make certain that you have a current status, which is acceptable, which means that you actually have to file a second application, which will stay in status while you're filing for green card status. But that will require a work authorization card, which requires that you then go through the do doctors, like a medical exam, and you have to turn in, I think, fingerprints and biometrics and other stuff like that. So it's very thorough in terms of what they want. But all this costs additional money, and so it kind of adds up over time.
It's like, sure, it's only a $100 application fee for this particular thing, but oh yeah, there's a $250.
No, it's usually around $500 or something for different parts of it. That's how it adds up. It's like $300 this, $500 that, plus you need to rush this back to us, so that's going to be another, you know, $40 to get something there or something like that.
Yeah,
so
go fax this to us, but the fax is going to cost you like $5 to send it.
Thankfully, I didn't have to rely too much on fax. No, it's more like needing to have like overnight express stuff to people.
Oh.
We're too close to the deadline. You need to send it. And so
don't send this 3 weeks in advance. Send it 1 week in advance.
Right.
Man, that's strict.
Yep.
How have you kept your sanity through all of this?
Let's see.
Because I'm willing to
the
bet
the real answer or is there the the public face.
Well, I'm thinking here, it's like, this has got to be very stressful for you to not know what your status is.
Well, I mean, I'm comforted by the fact that I have a status that keeps me in the country through until October. You know, I have a work authorization. And as long as the green card application is marked as in process, then my understanding is that I also have a window of time when I'm basically in limbo. And as long as I don't try to re-enter the country, I'm fine being here for like the length of the application.
And that gives you kind of like a, as you were saying, like a kind of like a stay of execution in a way.
Yeah, it's sort of a stay of execution. There are limits in terms of what type of work I can do because the authorization cards are usually tied to the degree that you just finished. Yes, I can work in any of the fields that are related to what someone with a degree in creative writing and literature might be doing.
That limits the field narrows the field a little bit.
So I do a fair bit of freelance editing and writing. I do, I build websites, but the websites are built for literary, purposes, like for other authors or Handbook Will Travel, for instance, is one of the projects I'm working on right now. I do some online mentoring and writing coaching, and I do volunteer work that's also within my field. So all these things fit within, the larger umbrella of what's acceptable. I couldn't pick up a freelance job, for instance, as a software programmer, even though the pay would be good.
Yeah.
Would not be permitted because it would be considered outside of my field. Nor could I pick up a fast food job or retail job unless I could make a strong enough case that it's within my field.
I'm recommending clothing based on your literary preferences.
Yeah. Maybe it's like Edgar Allan clothes, Raven Nose. Someone's going to run with this. And literary inspired fabrics and fashion.
The Telltale Hot Cuisine,
Yeah.
There's got to be a place in Baltimore that does this kind of stuff.
I thought, for instance, that any crossover between literature and food would be a good one. You could have a bakery a bakery of some sort called Remembrance of Things Past, and just serve madeleines, I had it considered at one point, it would be fun to have a place called Poetedery. It's poetry, but it actually has become Poetedery. But I thought it was too cheesy, so I ditched that idea. I've toyed with P-H FOOD, food, which would be sort of a food cart or food truck that sold dishes, different food items, all named after different fictitious courses.
Interesting.
So I thought that might be entertaining.
I could also see it being a food truck that specializes in philosophy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Are you eating this corn dog, or is the corn dog eating you? Do you really want a diet soda? Get your lunch with a dose of existentialism involved, you know? Question your choices.
The other thing you could have is you could have a hot dog truck called Schrodinger's Dogs, and they all come in a sealed container. You don't know for certain if there is a hot dog inside the sealed container.
We'd have to put some kind of dummy weight in there, though.
Yeah, yeah.
Of the equivalent amount so that you wouldn't know until you opened it whether you had a hot dog or cardboard.
Or you might offer, like, it will either be, like, a, you know, two different types of hot dogs, right? And so you don't know. It is simultaneously both this hot dog and this hot dog until you open the box.
Ooh, is it a beef frank? Is it a turkey frank? Is it a Polish sausage?
Well, I guess if you want to be cruel, is it kosher or is it not kosher?
Oh, I don't know if we could get away with a move like that.
I don't think
you
can get away with that one.
I think we get in trouble for a move like that. Now I'm thinking of all these different ones, like the yeast also rises.
Yeast also, I like that.
Yeah. Or something, you know, for a bakery. The bun also rises.
I feel like this is actually all now an extended Tonight Show Twitter thing that they do.
It's a hashtag war going
it's
on.
It's a hashtag war, yeah.
Yeah, there we go. We should start this hashtag war on this aftercast and start it up and see what happens with it.
Yeah.
You know, make food literary.
Again.
Again, yes. And I love students who think that, you know, writers are these high-powered intellectuals. Yeah, we are, but we're fond of stupid things like this.
Oh, yes, yes.
Exactly. Now I'm going to be thinking of ones all day, and I know it's going to be one of those down-the-stairs moments where you think of the best one, like, after you're down the staircase. Yeah. But back to my question, how have you been keeping yourself kind of sane through all this and you know, not letting it overtake you?
Well, I try to throw myself into other projects. It's really part of it, you know. And so I find whenever I have more time, then I need to find ways to keep myself busier. So one of the first things I did was I tracked down a local literary nonprofit to volunteer with. And so I started to get involved with there's a local organization called Right Around Portland. And they basically do workshops around the city. One of the things they try to do is they try to serve communities that often are not served. So the workshops are offered for free to, let's say, immigrant communities, to senior retirement homes, or to people that are in burn recovery or that are in juvenile detention. Or one of the places I volunteered at for a while was a workshop for those who had developmental disabilities, mental disabilities. And I served as a scribe, which basically meant I was paired up with one of the workshop participants who had difficulty translating what she was thinking about into actually using her hand to write it down. I would, you know, the instructor, the facilitator would have a prompt on the board, and then I would talk her through it and ask her questions to get her talking. And then I would just transcribe what she said in response. And it was just kind of, it was nice to be in a role where I was helping someone else. There was no pressure on me to perform or to deliver anything. My primary goal, my sole goal really, was just to find a way to unlock whatever was inside this other person and get it onto the page.
Yeah. Get them thinking. And then just transcribe what they were talking about.
Right. And it was very inspiring, actually, to see, you know, to work with someone that thought in a very different way than me, and to see her make connections that were unexpected and surprising, sometimes just downright beautiful and, you know, bizarrely beautiful, the things that I just fell in love with. I thought, I want to steal this, but we have ethical, you know, guidelines that say you can't steal work from your participant. So.
Most writers play by that rule.
It's called play.
I can think of a few famous ones who don't. You know, right.
But we try to honor sort of where the ideas come from. But yeah, so I loved working in that environment.
What were some of the most amazing moments in that? Do you remember any of the things that maybe a participant said that you were like, holy crap, that's great?
There are sometimes just associative activities, like where the prompt was that relied on association. And so sometimes it was, I think there was one that had to do with smells. One of the workshop participants, it was the smell of cinnamon reminded her of cooking with her mother in a kitchen, but it transported her back into time to actually a happier moment. But she then talked about sort of loss in there as well. And it was just like a really moving sort of description of how that smell could take her back to something happy and at the same time reveal sort of the depth of distance and loss. And then another person who was writing to another response to another prompt, and she was, she had Down syndrome, and she would write very eloquently about, was like, my dream is, was sort of the response, was sort of the prompt. And then she would write, and she wrote about wanting, this dream of having sort of a companion, a partner, a friend, a romantic partner, just to spend her days with on a bench or doing other things. And it was really deeply moving the way that she wrote about that. And so some things you just, you discover are, you're reminded of how universal certain desires are. You're reminded of how powerful the senses are, in the ways that they evoke memory and bring us back to different places. And even people whose thoughts are not linear at all, you discover what they return to over and over again as being important to them. And so their ties to their pets, for instance, become really important and meaningful. This is where they find an emotional connection that they don't really find anywhere else.
It's absolutely fascinating. I worked one time in my life as a activities coordinator for advanced Alzheimer's patients.
Mm-hmm.
And not the same as what you're talking about, but similar experiences. Seeing what connections they did have, what was working in their minds, and to see that point of view and to discover some of the most amazing things.
Mm.
And then you could sometimes get the most amazing conversations. I'll never forget this one. Patient said something like, I want to live to be 100. And I said, okay, I do too, but I don't think that's going to happen. And she looked at me and went, then we will raise hell. I was like, I want you in my life. You're awesome. I didn't know about this, but, I follow you on Facebook and such and see what you're up to. And you mentioned a moment ago, Half Poet Will Travel.
Yeah.
That's a whole new venture here that I don't know if our listeners are really aware of it. I was a little confused at first. So talk me through it a little bit. What is this? It sounds awesome.
So Half Book Will Travel is basically an online resource for authors who are looking to travel to promote their books and for reading series and event planners that are trying to schedule some voices from outside their immediate community. And it kind of grew about because I realized, as an author myself, I'm actually pretty terrible at planning book tours. And the source of my problem usually is that I don't know who to contact within a particular state or a particular city when I'm traveling. There's some parts of the country I just have no connections. And so I feel like there's a lot of missed opportunities. Like I don't know which reading series would be welcoming to someone passing through and how to reach them. And likewise, going to a lot of different readings in different parts of the country, you start to realize that there is a tendency after a while for some reading series to basically circle back on themselves and bring in the same voices over and over again because they don't know how to bring in or where to find writers and authors from outside their immediate circle. And even a university can suffer this problem where if they're planning a series of reading events for their school, they may find that they're relying heavily on their own personal connections and reputation as passed around by their colleagues. And, they might brainstorm and come up with a list, but that list may ultimately feel very familiar and split between very expensive, hard-to-book authors who are very well-known and writers who are basically just the friends of the people who are teaching there already.
Hmm.
So how do you bring in voices that are more diverse? How do you bring in voices that might speak to a wider community outside of your immediate region or location? And one of the ways to do it is to create sort of a searchable database of people that are advertising themselves as being available. You know, have little mini profiles of themselves, you know, so you see an image, you know, a photo, author photo, you get a sense of what their booking rate might be and how far they're willing to travel. You get a little bio blurb for each author, and you get their books and blurbs about their books. And in that sense, you can get a snapshot of who this person would be, who this person is, what they write, and how they might fit within a program. And it's searchable in the sense that it's all meta tagged. So you can click around and say, I'm looking for things in Colorado, and you would get a listing of everything, writers, you know, the authors and the reading series, and even venues, bookable venues that are available within that state.
So it's almost like a dating and matchmaking site for readers and for writers and readings.
Yeah, it's kind of a matchmaking site. I don't collect, it's all free. I don't, for authors and reading series and event venues, it's all free to list. You know, I thought about like whether or not I should charge some sort of fee for use, but I realized it just made more sense to leave it as a public resource, something that was free. That way it would serve the widest community possible and hopefully ensure a more diverse representation of authors, you know, in the listing. And so that was kind of the motivation for doing that. But the other thing I wanted to do, and this is what I'm working on next, the next phase is to start providing paid listings for boutique hotels and bed and breakfasts and artist retreats that are looking to connect to people who are traveling through or who are looking for a place to hole up for a few days to finish a manuscript or work on some new poems or a new chapter on a novel.
I could see this being extremely valuable. And like you're saying, I'm kind of shocked that no one had really done it before.
Yeah, I did my research and I really could not find anyone that had done this on this particular scale before. There are some small regional ones that were started, I'd say, about 10 years ago, and which aren't well maintained and definitely lack the – they don't leverage the advances in web technology that that this site does. So I built this around sort of the, you know, WordPress template and some modifications because I wanted to leverage sort of the advantages of like a content platform like that.
How many writers do you have right now listed, do you think?
It's about 150. I think I'm at like 147 right now.
You've only been in operation, what, a couple months with that?
Yeah, since about middle of March, I think it was. Yeah.
You get the word out, maybe get a few more on there. I'm sure that...
It kind of comes in waves. You know, what usually happens is like I'll put together a new profile and I'll post it to the site. The site automatically it was up until a couple of weeks ago, and I think something changed with Facebook, but it automatically populated or updated the Facebook page for Hat Book Will Travel. And then the other thing I do is I then also have a Twitter account where I post a link to the profile as well. And what's helpful about that is that people then retweet those profiles. And so it drives more people back to the site to check it out. It wouldn't hurt to get more people on board.
No.
I'd love to profile more people. And honestly, at this point, I've got the system is pretty streamlined for me to take it from the submitted profile information to the final profile on the site. And the biggest bottlenecks are usually tracking down a decent reasonably high resolution author photo, because not everyone has good author photos or knows what a good author photo looks like.
That's something I've wondered about, is that what makes a good author photo? You know, in acting, we have the headshots, and everyone knows about a headshot.
Mm-hmm.
But authors sometimes forget, and so they're like, here, just take a selfie.
Right, and I have to discourage people from using, using their webcam to take a photo of themselves at their desk usually is not going to work. Usually it's because your face is just too much in the center of the shot and it just occupies the full shot. So that's not really what you want. So the type of things that I'm looking for are, a high resolution, which usually means it's someone with a good quality camera, often a digital SLR camera has taken the shot. Then you get a much more precise, clean shot, and someone that understands lighting, because if the photos are too shadowed or there's problems with the contrast, problems it's too busy. If the shot is too busy, that's also a problem. You want to draw the attention to the face, but you also want sort of the general rules of composition to be followed in how a shot or a painting is composed.
But you also don't want like the Olin Mills mall photo of the boring ass background.
Right. I mean, I can't use, like, for instance, my own bedroom background, because that just looks like a bad passport photo and it's not really attractive. I find like if you can shoot against interesting textures, like for instance, like a weathered fence or a wall of some sort that has a little bit of age might be interesting. I've shot, like I had years ago, I had an author photo taken against a graffiti dumpster actually. And it's the rust in the background. You have to kind of, and this is where it's helpful to talk to a professional photographer, is you have to get a sense of what your own color, what colors are complementary to you that draw out your natural features and your skin tone, and what colors will make you wash out or feel, cold. And so, for instance, shooting against a blue background for me actually is usually a bad idea. It makes me look too cold and too pale. And so I have to find something warmer to shoot against. But other people, it's like different backgrounds or different colors will work well with them.
Has the website been successful so far in hooking people up?
Yeah, actually it has. I've heard from a number of people who have had really great experiences from the website. So I can tell you a couple. So there was a Kentucky-based reading series that posted a profile. We put up their profile before AWP. And I saw the event coordinator at AWP. She stopped by my table and she told me what had happened. And she said, within 3 days of being on your website, we got a flood of emails from different people interested in reading for our reading series. And within a week, we'd filled up our entire year's worth of readings.
Kick ass.
So it was like, wow, that worked out really well.
Yeah.
And she had said, where we are, Lexington, Kentucky, unless you're from the area, you may not realize it's actually a great destination, a great stop if you're on a book tour across the country. They're a university. They have money. They have an interest in promoting literature, and the community itself is actually much more literary than an outsider might expect.
And it's got good range to places like Cincinnati and Knoxville and such. It's right in the middle almost.
Right. And so it's like it's a decent spot to go to. And she said that in the past, it'd just been flown over and skipped over by so many people. And they wanted to figure out a way to kind of put themselves more on the map. And this worked out perfectly. I've also had other writers, authors contact me and say that they've started to get contacted by reading series that say that one of the ways they heard about this particular author was because the profile that had been passed around on Twitter had intrigued them. And so they'd clicked on it, looked over the person's profile, and decided this was an author that might work for their particular reading series.
Best of luck with this. We'll throw a link up on the Sapticast page when this episode goes up, because this is kick-ass. And I could think of a few authors that I might contact and be like, hey, check this out.
Please do. Please do. Like I said, it's all free. I, of course, welcome donations and any sort of support that people want to throw my way. But usually what I tell people is, like, if you want to chip in for, take me out for a virtual drink, or buy me a virtual lunch, and that's usually what I say. And
it's like, drop a tip in the tip jar, so to speak.
Right. And people are happy to do that. I've had, it's something like a 20% conversion rate. So, which is very high. Most online sites, or things that depend on sort of user-based donations get, more like a YouTube channel, for instance, usually has a 3% or less conversion rate in terms of who actually chips in.
Huh. Huh. These are things I do not know about because I've never asked for a dime for the show. This one's completely free because all out of my own pocket. I do it out of love.
Right. And I, you know, fundamentally, you know, at the core, this really is a labor of love. I do this because I really do feel like there should be a much better way for us to get the information about how to plan a reading series, how to plan an event or a book tour, or how to coordinate a reading series. It shouldn't be so much reinventing the wheel, and it shouldn't be so much of a reliance on personal connections. But we should have some other options available, and we should be able to help each other out. You know, the comparison that someone made was, if we were all bands, you know, music bands traveling across the country, rock bands, blues bands, whatever performing artists we would be sharing our gig lists and sharing information about who's a good person to play for and where's a good space to perform it. But as authors, we actually do a terrible job of sharing that information.
When you go on vacation, for example, a writer goes on vacation for a couple of weeks somewhere in the country, they could pick up a reading gig.
Right.
A small, quick reading gig to whip off while they're in, say, Nevada.
Exactly. Like, and that's kind of how I look at it. It's like, oh, if I'm going to be in Tennessee for something, let's see what else I could be doing at the same time.
You know, maybe make a couple of readings, make a couple of bucks, make some people happy kind of thing.
Right.
Well, yeah. Thank you for putting that together, you know. But I know that that's not the only thing that's been keeping you busy, especially in recent times, and I got to get into it because, well, what are we on? You know, and that is, you have started two podcasts.
They're underway. I'm actually kind of daunted by the amount of editing I just realized the other day I still have ahead of me. Really, there's two separate podcast projects. One is much further along, and it's something I'm calling the Lit Fantastic. And it's a podcast series where I interview writers of all sorts, of all types, from all over the country at different stages of their career. And we talk about obsessions, about the things that drive them, or the things that that recur in their work, or just show up again and again in their lives, things that they have a extreme fondness for or a fandom for. And so it's kind of a really interesting way, I feel, to get to know an author or a writer beyond their work and beyond the usual interviews that you hear.
I'm kind of familiar with shows like that.
I mean, like, I will admit, I mean, this podcast series is part of one of the inspirations for doing this, is that a more conversational look at what makes writers tick is actually pretty compelling and interesting.
There's very few podcasts like that. I keep up to date on what's out there in the Lit podcast world. Obviously, I kind of have to. But the most I see are, let's talk about the craft. Or they'll have meandering conversations that always keep coming back to it. But nobody's like, all right, that's off the table.
You know, and some writers have a really hard time leaving behind that model. I had an interview recently where the author kept wanting to return to the traditional, you know, interview topics.
Some writers don't know how to break through that. And I'm not dumping on authors. I'm not dumping on anybody for that. But it all depends on the guest. I've had guests go in all different directions. Mm. You and I, on our first episode, if people listen to it, I often say, it's like, if you listen to the Neil Akin episode, it's like, for the first 10 to 12 minutes, we're like two boxers circling each other, unsure of what to say because we don't know each other. But then we found we both had an interest in sci-fi, and there's like, at the 15-minute mark, there's suddenly something happens, and we click the rest of the episode.
Mm. That's kind of what I want to do, which is like, skip the 10 to 15 minutes of kind of dancing around the ring trying to figure out how we each box and jump straight to the obsession part, the thing that we share in common. Or sometimes it's something that I know nothing about, and it's fascinating to hear someone unpack and explore their obsession with something.
Yeah, and you learn something in the process about what's cool about the thing?
Yeah, exactly. In some of these interviews, we start off thinking that it has nothing to do with the writing. And they'll even say, this has nothing to do with what I write. But by the end of the interview, it's like we've started, it's like a therapy session sometimes where we like realize, oh, but it does. It does actually have something to do with how I write.
So you've been doing a lot of the recording, a lot of interviews. for this one.
Almost 30 at this point.
Okay, so you've got like 30 episodes almost banked.
Yeah.
When are you going to start dropping them?
Soon. This is July. So my goal is to have them start having them out this month. I volunteer at a local community radio station called KBOO FM. They are very interested in hosting the series. And so it will be part of their growing a podcast streaming portion to their radio station. So it's not necessarily aired live, but they do have a podcast portion that they're expanding. And they would like this to be one of the podcast series on it. Within the next week or so, the program page for the Lit Fantastic will be up. And then I'll start adding episodes as soon as I finish editing. I'm not certain what pace I'm going to keep up, but I've got a lot already recorded. So it'll probably be pretty close to weekly, I think.
How long are you gunning for the episodes to be?
A lot of them are around 25 minutes. Some I have more recorded material, but I probably can cut it down to around 25, 30 minutes each.
Before doing this, how much did you have a lot of audio editing experience?
I had a little bit of experience. I mean, I've recorded, you know, I have a SoundCloud account where I basically record. It sounds so narcissistic, but I record myself reading like poems. So there are audio versions of some of the poems in my first and second book. And I do that partly for my own training so I can get a better grip on my own reading technique. And then partly, like some of the recordings are of more popular texts that are not like me. There's a recording of me reading Dylan Thomas's A Child's Christmas in Wales, which was like a much beloved family favorite when I was growing up. My father would read it to us every Christmas, and he would do a whole bunch of voices with it. And I barely do, I think I do a decent job, but I don't rise quite to my father's level of technique and expertise. But I enjoy doing that one. And then I did a recording of The Grinch That Stole Christmas. And I've noticed that gets played around Christmas time by a lot of people that like that. So the other podcast series I'm still not certain what I'm calling it. I think I'm calling it, well, its working title is Poets of Color Mixtape, or the Mixtape series. But basically, I kind of want a better title than that. I haven't thought of it yet. But the idea is it's modeled after sort of classical music programs on the radio where you might play a number of individual pieces and then you have the host will then identify what those pieces are, or he might lead in, he might bookend the performances in some way. So what I wanted to do is I wanted to play individual poems by poets of color reading their own work. And it would not be, there would be minimal to no banter, right? Like it's not like there's a big long preface from that particular poet. But instead the rules will basically be you read the title of the poem and you read the poem itself, you know, as if it were a piece of music. And then, you know, I would then go through and describe the set or describe, you know, what had been read. But you would listen to a whole bunch of different voices, and the focus then would be drawn to the words, to the experience of listening to the poems, and not so much about worrying about the stories around the poems or worrying about the biographies of the people, but just hearing the poems for what they are. And then maybe, at the end, hearing a little bit more about the individuals who, you know, the authors behind the poems.
Feels like that comes out of, correct me if I'm wrong, you've been to a lot of readings, poetry, fiction, otherwise. Does it bother when you go to a reading and the poet gets up, they spend 3 minutes talking about their piece or more, then read the poem? Or do you prefer it when it's almost machine gun style?
Well, here's the thing. I feel like there are some readers, some poets who do an excellent job of offering sort of this banter between poems, which I think is actually helpful in a longer reading set. So if you've been asked to read for half an hour or 45 minutes someplace, no one wants to hear 30 minutes or 45 minutes of machine gun poems. It's just exhausting. And so you break it up and you tell a story or an anecdote But it's not so much that you have to preface every single poem. It's that's its own sort of artistry of storytelling, is how to weave, a series of poems together in an interesting way. At an open mic, I do feel a little frustrated when people expend too much time trying to preface things and explain things, or even rationalize or justify what the piece is. I'd rather have the poem do that work. If I'm really interested in learning more about sort of the context and situation of the poem, then I will do my own research, or I'll ask the poet after the reading about the poem. But I don't really need more than a couple seconds, into and out of the poem.
I feel that way when I saw bands. That's where it came out of for me. When I would go see bands, and you've got a mediocre band on stage, and they spend like 3 to 4 minutes setting up the song, and I'm like, shut up and play. That's why I'm here. You've got 30 minutes to wow my ass, and you're sitting there going, this song is about an ex-girl that I dated back in college. We broke up, and I wrote this song about her. And the band's just standing around going, come on, get the damn song, man. Yeah, we know the tune. The kids don't care. I don't
So
know.
I think, so the object for this one, for the Poets of Color series, is really just to strip away narrative and to kind of like, I just want people to hear each other's voices and hear the poems themselves.
Especially poets and writers of color.
Yeah, too often, here's the problem I feel like. Too often, the person's identity, their racial appearance or their outward appearance or the narrative of how they came to the country or how their parents came to the country or their great-great-grandparents came to the country, becomes commodified and packaged and sold to the consumer, to the audience, in a way that overtakes the actual poem. While those things may be important, on some level, every poem, and this is speaking as an editor of a literary journal, every poem has to earn its place. You just can't, rely on your bio, rely on sort of a history, or a pedigree to earn your space. It's not enough. In fact, in most cases, I don't care. I don't care at all. I just want the poem to be something that I've never heard before that surprises me and pulls me in. This is the next big project, but I've already like realized that I have to tackle it differently than I've been doing this interview series.
In what way?
The problem with the interview series, I have to say, is that most of my interviews are done over the phone, and the sound quality is inconsistent. Some people have very good connections. Some people have landlines. And some people, the reception wherever they're taking the call is not great. And so volume levels or things get broken up. It's not great quality. And while it might pass for an interview, I'd rather have a cleaner recording for their actual poems. Now, the other thing that I've noticed is when I do ask people to read poems as part of their interview, they do fall into the trap of sometimes giving too much of a preface. And I think it's fine in the interview context, but it means that I can't really pull those poems out separately and play them. In some cases it will work. In some cases it does. They've chosen a poem that does rely on, a fair amount of contextualization to really get it. And so I think if I change things around and basically say, look, record yourself reading, two poems or three poems, but here are the rules. You have to begin with the title. You don't mention your name, and you just read the poem. So no name, no context. You just read the title of the poem and the poem itself, and that's it. Send me those recordings, and then I will do any cleanup that needs to happen. In terms of if there's background noise that they've missed, I can clean that out. But in general, then I'll have like a perfectly isolated sound file that I can just add together with others to make a particular episode.
Works. And then if you want to get more context, more preface, you can get that from them.
Right. And then I can then redirect them to the author's websites. Or like mini bios, or maybe back to have book will travel. Who knows?
But we need the clean copy of the recording first.
Right.
works for me on that. How's that one coming along? You know, the Lit Fantastic, you said you got about 30 or so already kind of banked and ready to start working on. How's the mixtape, for lack of a better name, right now coming along?
At first, I thought it was coming along, but then I realized I didn't like sort of the sound, the audio quality of some of the recordings, because they were mostly done over the phone like that, or they were part of existing interviews. And I think, like, if the poems are organically fit into the interview, then they already fit into the interview. So why cut them out like that? So I think I'm going to reboot that project and start taking just submissions from people. The other nice thing about it is, if it is on the writers themselves to record themselves and send them in to me, it's less studio time for me.
But it leads to a whole host of problems as well, because writers can be inconsistent and forget, or some have never really recorded poetry before or fiction into a microphone.
Right. And there are a couple options, right? You can record into a microphone, or you can record into a, use your iPhone to record yourself and then send the sound file. Have you used that method before?
There's at least a couple of Saftacast promos I know where I've recorded off my iPhone some of the lines, and I'm actually kind of shocked at how good quality it is.
Yeah, that's what I was. Someone told me that they solved this problem of doing a podcast with someone that had a terrible phone connection by having them instead record their part of the phone call.
I've actually got an idea in works for a future promo of taking at least two iPhones and using them simultaneously and voice recording to do two different things in a car.
In a car.
I've got an idea. And I don't want to spoil it because, you know, that's the way I operate on the show. The laboratory, people who follow me on Facebook are always aware of the, you know, I'm always like, I have wanted for years to slip Stanky Leg into one of our promos, and I finally did it. That's a story for another time, the promos and everything, weirdness of us. But so kind of rebooting this project now, rethinking and everything, and are you prepared for when the show starts going live for tweaking it even then? Because
yeah, I feel like there's definitely, I know going into this that it's one of the reasons why I recorded so many interviews before I said it's time to start editing, is because I wanted to improve my own interview format and kind of iron out some of the details and figure out, like, for instance, when booking interviews for the studio, instead of booking exactly half hour for each interview and then sometimes running up until my limit, to instead book longer blocks of time so there was a buffer in there that I could, you know, maneuver around. So I didn't feel rushed going from one interview to the next interview.
Best of luck as it comes together, man. I'm going to be excited to see it because, you know, what you've been posting, and I'm like, this sounds awesome. Basically talking to writers about geeky things.
Yeah, and there's all sorts of really bizarre things that come up. You know, and I'm really excited about some of these interviews. Actually, all of them.
I would ask for a taste, but I don't want to spoil it. So we'll wait and see what you come out with and who you've got on there. And looking forward to it, as well as looking forward to the mixtape, for, again, lack of a better title at this time.
Yeah.
But also looking forward to that because, damn, the way you describe it, that sounds great, actually. Almost like a classical music program on NPR, but cooler.
So why don't we have that for poetry? I mean, I think it's kind of, I'm building things that I would love to see. And at some point you realize, oh, I have the skill set. Maybe I have the skill set and the time. Maybe that's me. Maybe I have to do that.
Totally agree. It has been great catching up with you, Neil.
No, this is fun. I really enjoy these conversations. I mean, obviously I enjoy doing these interviews because I keep interviewing people.
Yeah. And I enjoy having talks with you and catching up with you and what you're up to, as well as many of our guests, and we've got those projects to look forward to coming up. Is there anything in terms of writing that we're going to see from you in the near future?
Let's see. So what else is new? My chapbook came out earlier this year. So Leviathan is out from Hyacinth Girl Press. And that's like a collection of poems revolving around the life of Charles Babbage, the 19th century mathematician who invented, designed, partially built, but never finished what would have been the first computer, 130 years ahead of his time. And then the full book called Babbage's Dream, which contains more geeky topics like monologues from famous literary and pop cultural AIs and machines, and computer programming terms reinvented as lyric poetry, as well as the Babbage poems. That's due out from Sundress at the end of the year. I think the last I heard was November, December-ish. So
fourth quarter, right before the holidays.
Yeah.
Definitely going to look forward to that one as well. That might be on somebody's Christmas list that I know. So we will have to check that out, because nerd poetry is awesome poetry, especially when it's intelligent nerd poetry.
Thank you.
And much.
I have to agree. I'm always hunting for the same. So.
Because it's easy to write nerd poetry, but make it kind of crappy.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's a lot of stuff that's fun, but not necessarily compelling. You know, it's enjoyable, entertaining, but what I'm interested in is, like, when does, and I think this is really the Lit Fantastic as well, is when does something that we're a fan of or something that we're obsessed with become more than entertainment and instead somehow brings us a joy that we don't expect. So I will give one spoiler from the podcast series. I had this really interesting conversation with another poet about her love of visiting lighthouses. It wasn't that she obsessed about images of lighthouses or writing about lighthouses, but there was something about the journey to a remote location, to ascend up the staircase to the top of the lighthouse, and the idea of someplace so remote being sort of a beacon and at the same time being sort of a very, very isolated space that was compelling to her. And she's visited, I think she said, somewhere around 700 lighthouses so far.
Whoa.
And she's never written about them. And it was like, and I asked her, do you know why you do this? And she says, I still don't know why I do this. It's like stories like that that are really interesting. Like, how do we get there? And she does not fit the profile of, like, when she says she and her boyfriend go to these lighthouses, they don't look like anyone that's there. They're young. They're Asian American. They don't look like anyone that's there. And yet they're really interested and really invested.
I am interested and I am invested immediately now in checking this out. So I cannot wait for you to drop this. And I look forward to, I know it's a bit of work to get it going, but when it does, man, do keep us informed here on the program. We want to promote that, because damn, that sounds good.
Okay. Thank you so much.
All right. Well, Neil, enjoy the week here as it comes about, and do keep us posted on your upcoming events. And I hope you can handle the stress, man, of the next few months as you wait to hear.
Yes. Yeah. I'll be at least busy doing other things while I worry about, well, try not to worry too much about that.
Keep the distractions coming and keep good shit coming out, man.
Okay.
All right. Take care. We'll talk to you soon, I hope.
Okay. Thanks. Take care.
The SAFTAcast is a production of the Sundress Academy for the Arts. For episodes and more, visit SAFTAcast.com. Until we talk again, this is your host, Scott C., signing off.